art, comedy, pop culture, and much more. You're listening to ACPN.
Okay, here we go.
We can hijack your brain.
Okay, here we go.
Hey, everybody. I'm James Hatton.
And I am Podcast Rob.
And this is our 8th year anniversary month.
Yes,
so,
still continuing on the celebration of having done and been the Something Something Cast for eight years.
Yeah.
You know, it's been 8 years and it hasn't felt a day shorter than 8 years. I mean,
indeed. So, what?
No.
Oh, you were going to say
this
something?
Is our second week continuing the month-long 8-year celebration as
indeedly.
As we have certainly said in the first week, this which is
which we
haven't yet
recorded already.
This is and I've posted it on Twitter too. Like, I will say it again, and I will say it till the day we stop doing this show. This show has afforded us the opportunity to do so many different things and go so many different places that we otherwise normally wouldn't have, and talk to and meet and interact with so many people, amazing people, and talented and brilliant and generous and kind people that we otherwise never would have had any sort of interaction with but for this
1,000%.
Show. 1,000%. That it's amazing to me that people still give a shit about us after 8 years, and we're only growing. Like, I look at our listener metrics and our download metrics year over year for the past couple years, and our show is just getting bigger and bigger and growing by leaps and bounds. So we are 8 years old, and we're starting to hit our stride.
It took us this long just to get our feet wet. We go into the pool one toe at a time.
No kidding.
Oh. Well, since this is a bigiversary, and you'll notice a theme to this month's shows, we decided there's something very special about this. You probably already saw from the title. We are going back to a very specific well of ours, but we are touching on something we've never talked about, in so much as we are talking some Abrams, whom we've had quite the relationship with over the years. But
why, whatever do you mean, Mr. Hatton?
Oh, I mean, there perhaps was. And we have never discussed his Star Trek other than lightly, and that I find to be an abomination of the Trekkie name. But this right here, this film that he did in 1911, aught when Nickelodeons were but a glimmer in the eye. 2011 is probably at the height of my J.J. Abrams fandom, when I really kept appreciating what he did. He had also done a book around this time called S, which is based on The Ship of Theseus, which is a really interesting sort of meta novel. Anybody out there who likes the House of Leaves style book, this one I like more than House of Leaves. That said, it is Super 8, and it is, I say with, and I've said for years, one of my favorite movies of all time.
You have said this many times.
I have. When I've done lists of favorite movies, it usually appears on there. It scratches the exact itches that this movie sets out to scratch. And it's this movie that makes me think that whether or not we agree with Abrams and a certain island, he and I could probably have a very great conversation about nostalgia porn, because that's what this movie is. It's nostalgia porn. Well, but it does it very well.
100%. The interesting thing that I find about this in the big picture, not even getting into like the minutia of the movie, but just big picture, when you mention the date 2011 and that we kind of have a storied, quote unquote, history with Mr. Abrams, I was looking at the date of this in conjunction with a lot of other stuff that he's done, and oddly enough, this comes after things like Lost, like Star Trek,
yes,
like Mission Impossible 3, all of which he directed. And I find that interesting because this doesn't feel Abramsy to me. Like, you can watch certain things of his, and, you know, they joke about the lens flare kind of thing and how he frames certain shots. And this is probably one of the least, at least in my opinion, Abramsy films to come from him.
I agree. There is some of the lens flare-y, but it's not. Given the movie takes place in 1980-something.
78, I'm sorry, I believe,
1979, yeah. It doesn't have a lot of room for that. It does have some of it. There's the, at the beginning, there's the train sequence and there's some lens flare there just to sort of hide what's going on for the sake of effect later. But yeah, no, you're right. This was right after he had become a namedy name. And I don't know what it was about it that it was probably Cloverfield. 'Cause this is, right, let me see, what year did Cloverfield come out?
Cloverfield came out 2008.
There you go. So it's 3 years after Cloverfield. I was a big fan of Cloverfield.
Right. And he was only a producer on Cloverfield, too. He wasn't a director.
Oh, that's true. But it was between that and Alias and, yeah, Lost, of course. Like, there's the bigger picture of Abrams I have enjoyed. I think he has some mistakes made when it comes to the bigger franchises. We could talk Star Wars all day long. But this is him saying, I would like to write a love letter to Steven Spielberg. And hey, let's get Steven Spielberg on it. It's Amblin Entertainment with J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot. And he does, it scratches those itches. You can pick the nostalgia buttons of this movie out of other movies, you know, whether it's E.T., which is all over the place in there, Close Encounters, the beats he hits are those 1970s classic era science fiction movies, but it has a modern storytelling style. It has modern characters. And it just grabs at the stupid heartstrings, which is a major point we'll get into later, because there's an aspect of this film that I like, that I tend to not like about other films. I was all over this stupid movie. What was your experience? Did you have any hype machine over it?
So I didn't see it in the theater. I ended up seeing this when, I want to say it was probably on Netflix, I ended up seeing it. It was the first time I had seen it. I didn't have, like, a super big hype going into it. Like, oh, I have to watch this. I had heard, you know, murmurings and bits and pieces about it and stuff like that. But when I saw it, my first knee-jerk reaction was, like you said, this is nostalgia porn, and this is a love letter to Steven Spielberg. It really feels like it is J.J. Abrams attempting to, I'll say, catch lightning in a bottle again, but it feels like he's trying to do a E.T. style movie for a new generation of people.
Sure.
In very much the same way that when Cloverfield was done, even though he was only the producer on that, it still felt very, hey, we want to make a kaiju movie or, you know, a Godzilla movie, but American, not taking, you know, not like Sony Zilla did when they took fucking Godzilla and made him, you know, through New York and shit. But we want to make our own. We want to make an original, you know, USA American kaiju, but in the style of the big monster movies from the past. This feels very much the same kind of way.
The thing that I find the most interesting about this movie, sort of in retrospect, I wonder if this movie hadn't come out, whether Stranger Things would have. Like, this movie is so tightly, it feels so similar to Stranger Things in that Stranger Things replicated quite a bit. Now, the things they're replicating are the camera style, which is, it's just got a little glaze. There's just a Vaseline over the film, so it feels older. That sort of thing, you know, camera angles that feel sort of old, where for example, like the camera's at the table and you just have the cereal in front, you know, so it's all happening in the background. But there's a lot about Super 8 that like ties hand in hand with a Stranger Things. You could even tell me they happen in the same universe and I'd believe it. I do wonder whether Stranger Things would have occurred without Super 8. And I didn't do enough research to see whether it had some of the same people involved, like on the back end. But for as much as I enjoy Stranger Things, it does feel like it needed something like Super 8 or Super 8 and other influences to find its mark. Because again, it's feeding off that same nostalgia bump. So I do wonder. What are your thoughts?
I never actually considered the whole similarity between Super 8 and Stranger Things until you had just mentioned that.
Haha, making us smarter.
I don't know that I would even venture into making an argument that they possibly exist in the same universe. And I know that was kind of not... I don't think you were specifically making that claim. I think you were more feeling that they feel like they're cut from the same cloth. They're related, if only as like cousins or step siblings.
Very much so. Like if Super 8 was E.T., then Stranger Things is Firestarter or something like that.
Sure. No, I can feel that. There was actually an interview done quite a while ago with Kyle Chandler, who's one of the stars of the movie, that was asking is this supposed to be like the new E.T.? Is he trying to redo E.T.? Is this the next E.T.? And his response was basically it's not, but it's a similar model in the respect that children are the main stars of the film and the adults are kind of not necessarily the antagonists, but they're, you know, it's not humans versus creature. It's younger humans and creature versus older humans who don't understand what's going on kind of thing. So right. Again, very cut from the similar cloth, very much, like you said, Stranger Things, very much, you know, kid main stars of the story oriented. They are all kind of tangentially related.
Yeah, and the twist on that game that Super 8 does is the monster E.T. is, you know, E.T., Gizmo, let me think. I'm sure there's a dozen others that I can't think of off the top of my head. Those aliens are marketable in so much as they're cute, and you can put them on a video game, and you can put them on a lunchbox, and you'll sell some stuffies. The twist on that format with Super 8 is we are positioned to think that perhaps we are moving into, like, there was even rumors that this was the prequel to Cloverfield, or this was some sort of preface to Cloverfield, which it was not.
Right.
Because the monster, where ultimately innocent in so much as any horrible thing it's done because it was trapped by the government, is not cute. He is kaiju size. He is destructive. He kills a bunch of army dudes. And he's ugly as sin. He's a snarly, praying, mantis-faced, black, sleek creature. So I like that as the twist that this beast, the monster, it ain't pretty, and it is destructive, but it's destructive because... You know, look at it. Look what's been done to it. It's been locked up by the government for, I think in the movie they say like 10 years, 15 years.
Sure.
So the movie features a bunch of kids. I'll never remember all their names off the top of my head. They're making a movie, The Super 8. They're out at the train tracks, train derails. They catch that on cinema. But it was transporting said creepy monster. Along the way, you know, you learn the small town life problems. The main character's mother passed away in a, I believe it was a mining accident, And that ties with his love interest of Ellie Fanning, because his father was supposed to be, or her father was supposed to be working that day. Like, it hits all of those emotional beats. And the relationship between the two mains in, and now I'll pull the name so I don't sound like a complete dullard, between the father and son is, like, really at the heart of it. Kyle Chandler plays Deputy Jack Lamb. Since we are in a J.J. Abrams film, there must be a Jack. And his son, Joe. They have... There's a moment in the movie between them where Papa is like, you're not going to go hang out with those people anymore, and you're not going to go hang out with those friends and do that crap you're doing anymore. I'm the sheriff of this town, and they had somebody else looking after them, and now they just have me. And there's, it's this beautiful scene, probably at the end of Act Two, where he's telling the audience the plot of the problem between them two. And it's so beautifully acted without saying words, like right after the sheriff finishes saying it, they just do a couple slow shots of both of them sort of staring at each other as the sheriff kind of goes, oh shit, that's why you're mad at me. Oh, crap. But like he keeps his stiff upper lip because he's the sheriff and he's a tough guy. And the kid's just standing there with like tear-filled eyes. That scene and the end sequence of the film, because of, and here it is, the score of this movie, I've watched it. I want to say I don't watch movies anymore. Like I don't watch movies six times like I used to. I watch a movie twice. I rewatched it for this, and I probably watched it 3-4 years ago, but I've probably watched this movie every 2-3 years. I'm like, I want to watch Super 8. Like the only movies that ever go on my list like that are like Ocean's 11 and Willy Wonka. And the last, that sequence and the sequence at the end where they're sort of waving goodbye and he's got the necklace with his mom's picture in it. And oh, like wells to tears. Like a baby every time. Just, oh my God. And it's because the score of this movie is one of probably three I've ever... I have a copy of the score because I think the orchestral in this film is so perfectly encapturing that whole, like, yes, it's a science fiction movie. I put it up there with, like, the E.T., which I'm sure you can hear in the back of your head if you're thinking, or, like, let me think of some other ones. Terminator 2 is another one that I think has a brilliant score. There's just beats of this film that are perfect.
I would agree. I was also trying to look up the same thing. I was reading a article where they had said, in their opinion, the alien is almost kind of a MacGuffin to advance the story of the relationship between the characters and the relationship between the father and son.
Oh, sure. I can see that.
And I think that's really kind of accurate. And I don't know that upon the first time or two that I had watched this movie, I would have said that or thought to have said that without having read that from somebody else. But that does make sense. The pacing of the movie, in my opinion, was pretty good. It does... Somebody made a comment that it feels like it was taking lessons from his stint in TV. Mm-hmm. Because if you watch the movie, it's almost every half hour on the half hour that there's kind of an action sequence that happens, which just feels very episodic.
Yeah, I could see that. The movie definitely does have its sort of peaks and valleys in that. That makes sense.
But it's not your typical action movie in the sense that it feels like it's action for the sake of a big action set piece kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This very much is story driven and relationship driven more than anything else. And there was actually a quote from Roger Ebert that I thought was very telling about it. if I can find it. He said that Super 8 was a wonderful film. Nostalgia, not for a time, but for a style of filmmaking. And I think that is really kind of spot on, not sure. only because it's accurate, but because there's a movie within a movie being made here. You know, the whole title comes from the fact that the kids are trying to make their own movie on a Super 8 camera. And mm-hmm. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was in high school or college or just outside of school where, you know, we had friends and we were going to film our own movie. Like, that just seemed to be a common thing among my friends. I'm sure we weren't the only group of people who kind of went through that in our, you know, teenage and early 20 years where we were going to film a movie. So the fact that it's multi-layered in that kind of comment, that it is about a not necessarily just for a time, but for a style of filmmaking. It's the movie that Abrams made, and it's also the type of movie that the kids were trying to make. Mm-hmm. So I think it really speaks to the story overall in both senses of the word.
It's a great point. Because it's one of the first things I even said, you know, there's camera angles to this movie that make you, it feels like if you were to show somebody this film in a time machine and go, oh, this is a movie that came out in 1982. Other than the high gloss effects, which are, you know, above and beyond, the style of it, you really, the way the characters and actors, they hold themselves, really fits the time period, the camera angles. There's lots of little beats. And I think there's only, you know, I'll save that for a second. I did find the score writer's name. It is Michael Giacchino. He's worked with Abrams a bunch, but he does have a few movies on here that I'm like, you know what? Those are good soundtrack movies. He did Up. He did Speed Racer, the Wachowskis one, which, like, that movie is a soundscape. New Jurassics.
Just to clarify for you, when you say Speed Racer, the only thing that pops into my head is the Wachowski version. Like, there's no other definition that needs to be said about that.
But, I mean, that movie is just sound.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's such high
candy. And insane.
Yes. Yes, very much so. He's now part of the Marvel Cinematics. He did, his first one was Doc Strange. He has since done the Spider-Man ones. He did Rogue One. So he's got some name credits. I mean, he's also got a couple bummers on there, but I'm not going to blame him for being on Land of the Lost. But he does all the sound for the Jurassic movies too. And the Jurassic World series has, I enjoy those for their nostalgia porn too, in so much as, like, they're fun Jurassic Park movies. I'm not looking for anything amazing out of them.
Sure.
But there's one failing in this movie, and I probably, if I rewatched it, I could argue against it if I paid attention to the scenes abutting it. One of the big plot points is the loss of the mom, and the father wasn't really part of the kid's life. He was a mom's kid. And so since she passed, they're just like a mess. And the relationship between Ellie Fanning's father, who would have gone to work that day, but he was drunk. So the mom went to work and she passed away. The relationship between him and the father is ugly. It's uncomfortable. They forgive each other very quickly. Their sequence where, and it's right when the kids are in trouble, they're, you know, the government people have picked them up and they're taking them. I don't know whether Ellie Fanning's been caught by the monster at this point, but they're in a car and Ellie Fanning's father says, look, I was a fuck up back then. I'm still not the best person in the universe. I'm still kind of a fuck up, but I was a real fuck up back then and I'm sorry. And the father goes, it was an accident. Accidents happen. My wife would have wanted me to forgive you, so we cool. And I'm sure it's because at the end, it's he's realizing that, you know, we're fighting for our children, and it's your kids, it's my kids, it's our kids. There are bigger things to worry about than that bad day a year ago or 4 months ago. But it does come across very quickly. I really wish there would have been a longer conversation between the two than 15 minutes in a car before we get to Act 3. That said, it's a forgivable... it's forgivable when you kind of look at the big picture. I figured I had to throw in something negative about this movie. I gush about it enough.
No, you're right. And there's, I mean... It's not like they're the first movie to have done that, and it's not like they're the only movie to have done that. When movies need to get back to, you know, the action before everything gets derailed, yeah, there are character opinions and motivations that can, you know, flip at the drop of a hat. So I get it, and sure, it might feel kind of shoehorned and forced to move things along so we don't lengthen the movie by another 20 minutes to have them have a right. You know, more meaningful discussion of it. But you know, in the flip side of that, they could have, you know, filmed it in black and white and slow-mo and put Hallelujah under it and extended it for, you know, 45 minutes to have them have a very deep, meaningful conversation about the whole thing before getting back into it. And then when it didn't make it into the movie, people on social media could have clamored about getting the Abrams cut of Super 8, and we could have gone through that whole mess.
I don't know what you're talking about. Movie could possibly have done such a thing? I still have not seen that, and I am quite content not having seen it.
Will not see it.
I might one day. I'll be bored, and the Riff Trax version will come out. To jump to the box office, it had a production budget of $50 million, came out, and let's see, grossed $35.4 opening weekend with a final of $260.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty good return on your money. Was nominated for a whole slew of none of the Biggin awards, which I'm surprised by. I would have expected it to have maybe gotten a visual effects award or something. But Ellie Fanning was the sort of star of the show. She walked away with, you know, breakthrough award, supporting actress awards all over for it.
Sure. Now, I know, you know, inflation is what it is and everything, but for the debut movie of J.J. Abrams for Amblin Entertainment, because this was the first one that he did for Amblin,
mm-hmm.
$50 million and a return of $260 million. I know commercially, yes, hey, it made money. But I almost feel like in this day and age, in you know, 2019 to 2021 kind of day and age, I think they might look at those numbers and be disappointed that it didn't do more.
I mean, that's especially a Spielberg's name's on the box.
Yeah, a Spielberg and J.J. Abrams movie that only brought in five times what the budget was. I almost feel it might be, again, not a disappointment, but a...
No.
That was pretty good.
Now, let's compare it to, I pulled up real quick, the top 20 grossing of 2011.
Sure. We'll
just go through the top five. We have Harry Potter Part 2, which obviously that's going to be your big in. That was 1.3 with a B billion. Transformers Dark of the Moon, which I'm shocked made over a billion. That was 2-3 weeks after this movie came out. Caribbean, Pirates of the Caribbean, Stranger Tides, Kung Fu Panda 2, and Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1.
Right.
And then number 6, Fast 5. So, and that, I mean, those are big drop-offs because we go to $626 million. Hangover did 5. The Smurfs did 500 million?
Right.
What? I'm sorry. I'm so more amazed at that. But no, you're right. It comes in at number 19, right underneath Rango, which I also saw in the theater that year.
And to be fair, now that I'm kind of looking into this, it would be interesting to know when these were released. Like, I know, yes, 2011, but like Transformers Dark of the Moon opened over the 4th of July holiday weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing it reach 180 million over that weekend, not really a surprise.
Yeah, June 10th.
Yeah, so Super 8 came out in June, so it was kind of in that. I feel it's like that not a whole lot going on in the movie theaters summer kind of time frame, because...
Which makes sense. If you think about it as an untested property, when it's going up against Potter number 35, Caribbean number 64, Fast and the Furious number 5... You know, it makes sense to try and keep it at the beginning. Let people, hey, here's something new for the beginning of the summer before you go and watch all the movies you're going to go watch and we know it.
Yeah, like other movies that came out in 2011, like you said, Fast Five, Thor, Deathly Hallows Part Two, First Avenger came out in 2011. Midnight in
First
Paris,
Class.
Midnight in Paris, Moneyball, yeah, Cabin in the Woods. On Stranger Tides, First Class.
Man, I went to the movies a lot that year.
Yeah, I'm just flipping Dark of the Moon. I'm trying to look at like some of like the big names that I'm seeing here. I mean, yeah, Green Lantern, Ghost Protocol, Immortals, Sucker Punch, Jesus, Super 8, Bad Teacher, Real Steel.
Lie.
I mean, depending on when this came out and what it was going up against, they may have strategically said, hey, let's try to set it for, you know, a month that there's not a whole lot of competition, because we don't want to get it completely blown out. Because I'll be honest, if this opened up on the same weekend or even within a week of Fast Five opening, I don't think this movie makes $250 million.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And there's a bunch of the same, maybe not the same people are going to go see it as, say, Twilight. But there's definitely crossover with Potter or crossover with any superhero movie. I think 260, even, you know, when comparing it to that summer of films, it's pretty big. Like, I'm shocked to think about how many films I saw that summer, because there's quite a few on there. 260 sounds okay. But what about you folks out there? What did you think of Super 8? Does it rank amongst your favorites? Are you astounded that I like it as much as I do somehow? Where can they tell us what to do with that information?
You can go to somethingcast.com, which has all of the buttons and widgets and links and doodads on which you can find us on various forms of social media, like Twitter, like Facebook, like Twitch. You can follow us on Twitter at STSTcast. You can hit us up on Gmail at somethingsomethingcast@gmail.com. You can find us all sorts of various and sundry places.
And since it is our 8th year anniversary, it wouldn't kill you to send a card.
They'd have to know where we live for that. And that's, I mean, 8 years in, not willing to... You can send us a message on Twitter. Say, hey, happy anniversary, guys.
Well, thank you all for joining us.
We will be continuing the theme of 8 for the rest of the month. So
pieces of 8.
Yes, be prepared for that. There will be more 8 coming in the remaining weeks. But again, you know, 8 years, we want to thank everybody who's listened, whether you've listened from the start, whether you just started checking us out this week or last week. It all means a lot, and we see you. We appreciate you. We thank you for being there for us. We hope you stay with us to continue the ride. I'm looking forward to the rest of our 8-themed month to push through the rest of this month and continue on and start our 9th year of podcasting.
1,000%. And we don't just see you, we're watching you.
Oh yeah. No, we see you. Stop that.
Put it away. I'm James Hatton.
Podcast Rob.
We'll see you next time.
Later.
Okay, here we go. We can hijack your brain. something, something, something.
Okay, here we go.